Food is such a daily experience, and yet so many mysteries surround food. Its substance of this planet that evolved along with us and maybe got worked around a little bit that we then take into ourselves, and it fuels not only our energy and our movement, but our consciousness, our experience itself. The fact that you're hearing me right now is because of food, anything you're conscious of. Of all the ways that we relate to nature, taking some part of it and placing it into your mouth and chewing it and swallowing it and letting it become you, perhaps that way of relating to nature is one of the most intimate that we ever do. So many mysteries surrounding food, so many paths that we could embark on in considering spirituality and food. Here now is the food mystery that I chose to begin our considered reflection. A man walks into a doctor's office. He has a cucumber up his nose, a carrot in his left ear, and a banana in his right ear. "What's the matter with me?" he asks the doctor. The doctor replies, "You're not eating properly." Well, that was a food mystery easily solved, but others are more difficult. For example, if you were to eat, I've always wondered this, and maybe it's because I'm not from the East Coast, but if you were to eat equal amounts of pasta and antipasti, would you end up just as hungry as when you began? Well, it's Woody Allen right when he said that the food in New York restaurants has two big problems. First, it tastes terrible, and second, such small portions. And finally, why is it that the typical American breakfast asks for only a day's effort from the chicken, but a lifetime commitment from the pig? Some groans there, right? Some not quite as funny as some of the other ones. Well, we joke about food because we take questions related to food so seriously. What food to eat? How to eat it. I have a 3-year-old. I'm spending so much time with him about how to eat his food, what to say before eating it, who to eat it with. And more recently, we're waking up to the impact that our food choices make. Nowhere is it easier to see the interdependent web of all existence than in our food choices, which I've come to realize link us to environmental justice and worldwide hunger and malnutrition. Food insecurity, when people just don't know where their food is coming from, which is endemic in the Boston area. Labor issues, animal welfare, environmental degradation, climate change. We're connected to these issues through the choices that we make 3 times a day. Martin Luther King actually said, "Before you finished breakfast this morning, you relied on half the world." Every day we subsidize one type of food industry or another with what we choose to buy or grow. Whether or not we intend to, every time we give money to one of these producers rather than another sort of producer, we're voting for a particular future. Some of those futures very much in line with our values, and some very much not. So as I mentioned, I'm one of tens of thousands of UUs who have embarked on an exploration of how our food choices are part of how we live our spirituality in the world. You know, most world religions worth their salt talk about food as being very related to the religion's ethics and practices. Unitarian Universalism, oddly, has never really embarked on that conversation until recently. And so we have lots of different starting places and lots of different names for the journey. Some that I've heard are choosing compassionate consumption or mindful eating or food justice or even my favorite, stirring the pot. Like our faith in general, our personal and congregational food justice work doesn't have agreeing on one set of answers as its goal, right? The idea is each of us bring our own particular life experience, our own particular wisdom and issues that we care about. Some congregations will get involved in field trips or movies. I know you're going to be showing Cowspiracy, which is why I originally chose this sermon topic for you.
And to imagine that hundreds of thousands of UUs, after going through their own internal and external conversations, will arrive at some common denominator is wishful thinking, or not even something I would wish for. Because ours is an evolutionary faith, and we figure out our answers as we go. No one's idea of truth is a tombstone marking the resting place of truth. It's rather, as Clarence Russell Skinner said, a milestone on the long and arduous journey to the truth. So we get to where we're going by being in conversation and disagreeing and talking respectfully about our different perspectives. That's part of what it means to be a UU. So the goal for any conversation like this one is not to get you to like the food that I like or to think about food the way that I do, which would be hard anyway because I'm still in process, I'm still learning. Rather, the goal that I have for you is for you to ask, how does being a UU, how does your being a Unitarian Universalist relate to the food choices that you might consider making going forward? And I'm not talking about necessarily a global once and for all change. It might be something small. So I imagine when I ask this question, I evoke some of the frameworks that are out there in the larger culture around similar questions. Some people think that choosing compassionate consumption means figuring out what sort of food is bad and then glumly committing yourself to depriving yourself of that favorite food in service of your values. Those folks will encourage your willpower by appealing to your self-interest and saying, you are what you eat. Or they'll refer to food justice work as duty and obligation. We need to put our faith into action, right? It can't just be words. We have to think about the legacy that we're leaving. It's hard work, but it's got to be done. Or without any specific reference to why you ought to feel ashamed of yourselves or guilty, they'll suggest that spirituality involves sacrifice and say our core values are worth sacrificing for. Actually, that would have been an easier sermon to write. But today I'm going to do the opposite and set the table with three counterintuitive pieces of food for thought, three surprising ways of thinking about UU food spirituality. See what you think, see how it feels for you. But since I'm up here, here's me. First, it has been said, you are what you eat. But I say, you are not what you eat. Second, it has been said, put your faith into action. But I encourage you, when it comes to food, take your faith out of your actions. Just take it out. I actively hope you will take your faith out of your actions. Third, many people have tried to persuade you that eating well means sacrifice and following food rules, not just any food rules, but their food rules. Michael Pollan says, eat food, not too much, mostly plants. Mark Bittman's book VB6 suggests that we all be vegan before 6 p.m. You know, it's a rule. I say forget food rules. UU food spirituality is about the joy of just eating, and we should eat whatever makes us happy. So those are my three points. You are not what you eat. Take your faith out of your action and eat whatever makes you happy. Where is he going with this? First, you are not what you eat. Consider, the biggest meat and poultry company in the world, Tyson Foods Incorporated, which nets $25 billion in annual sales, and also consider, next to its massive conglomerated factories in Springdale, Arkansas, consider our Unitarian Universalist Service Committee partner, the Northwest Arkansas Workers' Justice Center, which is about one room in a little rundown strip mall, a tiny volunteer-run nonprofit just a few blocks away from the $25 billion Tyson. At Tyson, conditions for workers are beyond challenging. Imagine actually being one of those workers, one of your brothers and sisters, human beings whose job it is to do that every day. Imagine working on a chicken disassembly line that slaughters and processes about 6 million chickens, 50,000 pigs, and 25,000 cows each year. Oh, I'm sorry, I misread that. It's 6 million chickens, 50,000 pigs, 25,000 cows each month. Oh, I'm sorry, let me check here. Oh, I've got it. It's each day. 6 million chickens, 50,000 pigs, and 25,000 cows each day. The number of animals that we kill for humans to eat each week is 1.2 billion worldwide. And just by point of comparison, if you think about the number of human beings that have been killed in all wars throughout all known history over the entire planet, we kill more animals to eat every week. And when I say we do, I mean human beings are the ones doing the actual work of that. So imagine what this must be like and is like for workers every day. Most slaughterhouse line workers are women, and most are people of color. Slaughtering and processing animals' bodies using sharp butchering equipment at high speed on disassembly lines is dangerous and unsanitary. In a survey, 2/3 of all workers in poultry processing plants report suffering from job-related illness or injury. So just imagine if 2/3 of the people in this sanctuary were suffering from a job-related injury or illness. It's inconceivable, frankly. And yet recently, the U.S. Department of Agriculture proposed letting individual poultry line speeds increase from 140 birds per minute to 175 birds per minute. So now you get an idea of why the UU Service Committee is in Arkansas working to improve conditions, working to force employers like Tyson to respect human rights. But as long as consumers are willing to buy and eat Tyson chickens, which is the sort of chicken, I mean, factory farmed chicken and factory farmed meat is 98% of the meat in the world. As long as consumers are willing to buy and eat that, UUSC has a very tough road ahead. So my point is this: you are not what you eat. In this interconnected world, I am what you eat. We are what you eat. Workers' lives are affected by what I eat, and the Earth's climate is what we all eat. We like to think that what we eat is our own business, thank you very much. It is, I would offer, a spiritual awakening to realize that you are not what you eat. We are what you eat, all of us. In our chalice lighting, UUSC President Reverend Bill Schultz said, "We must hold the whole world in our hands, but every time we pick up a piece of food, we already do." Let us pause a moment in silent reflection. So, first, we are what you eat. Second, it has been said, put your faith into action, but I suggest we take our faith out of action, perhaps entirely. In fact, I actively hope we take our faith out of our actions. And to share with you what I mean, I'd actually like to ask for some volunteers. I have recently lost some faith in our ability to mitigate climate change, and I would like to invite you into a similar loss of faith so that I can speak to a stronger source of strength in the face of some of what we're going to be looking at as humanity in the years ahead. So I'd like to ask for a few different volunteers, and your job will just be to stand and represent a year in time, and I'll have some string I'll ask you to hold, and that's the whole job. So to start, I need someone to represent 1890 and someone to represent 1910. And just come to the front, if you would. So
approximately, the first time that we extracted any fossil fuels from the, come on forward, whoever the other volunteer was, the first time we ever extracted fossil fuels, is there someone running sound who could help? Yes, thank you. In a way that could impact the environment in any measurable way, approximately was 1890. And since then, it is, I think, fair to say that our extraction and use of fossil fuels has doubled every 20 years. So, you know, some 20-year periods a little less, some a little more, but for our purposes, fair to say. So if you could come stand pretty close here. That's good. That's good. Actually, and just step aside so you're pulling the string taut. That'll make it easier for me. So here we have 1890, the first time any fossil fuel was used. Here we have 1910, and now I need someone to represent 1930. And we're going to have twice the amount of fossil fuels expended between 1910 and 1930. So actually, if you could come down the aisle here. This is the amount we were at in 1930, and now I need a 1950. And I want to get this approximately right. Oops. Could you hold on to that for a second? And could you hold that for a moment? There you go. I guess that can roll. It can roll out of control, can't it? Okay. So we have 1890, 1910, 1930, 1950. Would you come this way, please? The other thing I want to mention as we do this is that the climate effects of fossil fuel release, as I understand it, I'm not a scientist, but they tend to show up about 50 years down the line of the release. So what we're, is that right, 50 years? Did I more than double the length, do you think? Well, we should get this right, so.
I think it's right.
It's double the.
Is it double?
Oh, you're right. You're right. You're right. Thank you. I think it is just double the.
From here?
Yes, I'm sorry. See, this is how we're better together. So that means yours is correct, right? But yours.
Yeah, this is right.
But this one should be there to there. And that is all. Okay. That's all. So in summary, we're feeling the effects today, you know, the beginnings of climate change from about 1970, and anything that's happened since 1970, we're not seeing yet. You're 1950, am I remembering correctly? So we need someone to represent 1970. Would you hold on to that for a moment? Okay. So this is, I got it, so you can drop it there. So this is where we were in 1970 in terms of the amount of fossil fuels released into the environment. We can, maybe you all should back up a little bit. Okay. So I think for purposes of time, I might leave it here unless someone really wants to see how far away 1990 is. It's on Center Street, yeah. I mean, so to get, this is where we're feeling the accumulated effects of, right? But actually, by the time we got to 1990, we had emitted double this much more. And then by the time we got to 2010, we had emitted double that much more. So I feel like I'm exponentially making my commute home this way, right? I mean, this is, I can't even imagine where 2010 would be. Roslindale, do you think so? All right.
So thank you to the volunteers. If we could have some applause. So what does any of that have to do with food choices? Well, it turns out that a lot of our food is very connected to fossil fuels. Not in the ways that we typically think. You know, as I mentioned, eating local may not do as much as we think it does in terms of offsetting or mitigating climate impact. 4% of the impact that food production, transportation, and all that has on the environment, just 4% is from transportation. A lot of the rest of it comes from how many inputs you're putting into food. Like, are you creating one crop that is then getting fed to another crop that is then getting fed to another crop because you're losing so much energy along the way? It turns out that one of the reasons that I have been vegan for 20 years is that the animal agriculture sector does more harm to the climate than the entire transportation sector. The UN came out with a report on this that was a little flawed, and they went back and corrected the flaws because they had included they'd included animal transport in the transportation sector. But even separating that out, animal agriculture has a worse impact for the climate than all buses, trains, planes, semis, everything that you can imagine that's involved in the transport sector. So what that, interestingly, not only on that macro level, but also on a micro level, you know, switching to a plant-based diet, depending on the sort of car you drive, tends to make a bigger difference for the climate than buying a hybrid car, which is something you can do if you can afford it, you know, every so many years, whereas making a switch of just one type of food, like one day a week, or doing something before 6 p.m. or whatever it might be, is something that you can do immediately. So my point is that I think we're decreasingly going to be in a position of being able to put our faith into action. I think that we don't know what will be happening to our planet in the decades ahead, and it will be hard to know what exactly to have faith in that regard. And I have found great comfort in a term called active hope, which was coined by Buddhist philosopher Joanna Macy. It involves being clear about what we hope for and then playing our role in the process of bringing that about. So it's not passively hoping something will happen. It's saying, well, I want the world to be a certain way. I'm hoping this for my grandchildren. I'm going to do my part to bring that about. It's a journey of finding and then offering some unique contribution in service of your values. And when you do that, it helps you discover a new sense of strength and open to a wider network of allies and experience a deepening of your own aliveness, because you discover the vast community of people who are engaged in this work and who care just as deeply as you do about these issues. It makes the mess that we're in not only easier to face, but it also makes our lives become more meaningful and satisfying. And maybe if you start with active hope, you can find faith through the actions that you take and begin to take faith out of your actions. So I'm going to not have us pause for reflection, because the exercise was one I've tried for the first time here, and I've taken a little longer with it than I intended, and so I'll just summarize my final of the three. The first was, you are not what you eat. The second is to take your faith out of your actions and to say, I actively hope you do that. And the third is to eat whatever makes you happy. And by that I mean something different than eat whatever gives you pleasure. Pleasure is usually momentary and passing. For me, happiness is the best definition I've ever heard that's concise is satisfaction that continues to satisfy. It's wonderful in the moment, and then looking back at it, you say, yeah. That wasn't actually the concise definition, but my interpretation. Yeah. So what if we ate less for passing pleasure that often turns to regret, but made choices about what to buy that were based on our own deep satisfaction and the satisfaction of others? As I mentioned, we're subsidizing different futures when we make food choices. Some of those create they further degrade people whose lives are already burdened and further exploit natural resources that are already destabilized. Others build the world that we dream about, where rights are respected and creation is honored. And for me, I find great comfort in the idea of a welcome table. That's the idea that started in Judaism, where you left a place setting open for Elijah. And Jesus transformed the idea some when he started dining with prostitutes and tax collectors and lepers and other social outcasts, you know, those people we might be nervous to share our dinner table with today. But he did something radical and helped us discover that those people aren't those people. When you get to know them, they're my people, our people, us. And for me, a Unitarian Universalist welcome table would be one that I could set and I could invite anyone in the world to come enjoy, whether it was a farm worker or an animal, beasts of the air, birds of the field. I could not feel badly for what I had put them through or asked of them in order to bring whatever spread before them, which means I've had to change a lot in terms of buying more organics, because I don't want someone to sit down and say, oh, well, these are the carcinogens that gave me what I ended up with. But it's been a blessing to look at my table and say, well, this expresses my values and my spirituality, my compassion, my respect, my reverence for the earth, and it brings me back to my spiritual center, even just the small ways in which I've been able to do that. So I would invite you to not just shut out this set of issues because it's too intimidating or too threatening or too hard to imagine how you would ever begin. You can begin by doing something as simple as saying, well, instead of buying conventionally raised red leaf lettuce, I'm going to buy organic red leaf lettuce. And you do that for a year or however long it takes for you to feel comfortable and normal about that. And then you start asking, well, now what might I do? In our infinitely interconnected natural world, it matters what we do. It matters what we eat. And it matters that there is a joy to be found in just eating, eating what makes us truly, deeply happy. And that's a power that is in each of our hands, the power that we each might choose to take up in some small way to bless the world 3 times a day. Shalom. Salam, namaste, blessed be, and amen.